When you listen to the radio, do you ever think of it as a tool of soft power? Last year, when the bulk of funding was removed from the United States broadcaster Voice of America, there was a lot of talk about soft power. The service had been seen as a vital way to communicate a message of democracy and freedom to the rest of the world. But radio frequencies across the globe stopped carrying its broadcasts, newsrooms closed, and staff sent home. The president signed an executive order to strip it back, accusing it of being anti-Trump and having a left-wing bias. A White House statement said the order would ensure taxpayers are no longer on the hook for radical propaganda. One critic called the decision soft power suicide. Soft power, that subtle act of persuasion, can be dated back to when sounds first started to travel across continents 100 years ago. Nations, for the first time, could quickly and effectively try to make people beyond their borders see the world through their eyes using radio. But with the internet and social media revolutions, and funding priorities changing in the West, the Voice of America wasn't the first Western broadcaster to go quiet on shortwave radio. The soft power war of the airwaves has now moved to a decisive phase. Is international radio still needed? And if it isn't, what has been lost? Will there be a void? And who will fill it? I'm Josephine McDermott, and I make programmes for the BBC World Service. I also love delving into audio history and bringing to light the bits you might have missed. And in this case, it includes some astonishing sounds from around the world. We'll meet the people who established that soft power tool, international radio, the people who listened to it, produced it, and devoted their lives to it, focusing particularly on how it has been used in the ideological battle between East and West. As we reflect on the peak of radio's global influence in the 1970s and 80s, we'll revel in that on-air League of Nations from Radio Austria International.
Österreichischer Rundfunk, Wien.
Austria calling from Vienna.
To Radio Tashkent in Uzbekistan.
Radio Tashkent calling.
And the sounds lost to time. We'll shine a light on the Netherlands' feel-good messaging to the world.
This is the Happy Station Show, your Sunday family show of smiles across the mile.
And we'll dip into Moscow mailbag for some Soviet seduction.
Well, who's our first letter from today, Edward?
An old friend of yours, Doris, Brian Hartley of Fontaine-le-Field, asking what...
We'll uncover some of the surprising ways that cultures have crossed.
Four of the Russians joined the Archers cast to improve their skills. They'd been taught from scratch in Moscow by a former Archers editor.
Yes, a Russian version of the Archers in 1994, and the utterly unique experience of a broadcaster born in New Zealand who came to become the global voice of the Albanian Stalinist regime.
You just didn't do research because another side of the story would come out and the truth would come out, and then where would you be?
After 100 years, has radio as a means of soft power now run its course? If we're going to find out if the world needs radio for soft power, let's find out what it is. Professor Joseph Nye held top jobs at Harvard University and in the US government, particularly under Democrat administrations. He coined the term soft power, believing America's global influence was built on more than its military might.
Power is the ability to get what you want from others, and you can do it three ways. You can do it with coercion, you can do it with payment, or you can do it with attraction and persuasion. Coercion and payment I call hard power. The ability to get what you want through attraction and persuasion is soft power.
That can be everything from student exchanges to trade deals and feature films. But how did radio come to be used for attraction and persuasion? First, I'm taking you back right to the start and how radio went from apparently disconnected sounds to rousing entertainment featuring the biggest stars of the day. Radio begins with experiments in the early 1900s, building on the wireless transmissions of Guglielmo Marconi. They sent dots and dashes of Morse code, spark-generated pulses that were effectively a kind of cipher and had to be transcribed to make any sense. The people experimenting as a hobby, called amateur operators, were ordered off the air during World War I. But in 1920, the world's first commercial broadcasting station with the call sign KDKA opens in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the United States. It's evolved from weekly experimental broadcasts from the garage of a man called Frank Conrad. One of the many people fascinated by this in the UK is a young man born in Mexico called Peter Eckersley, as he recalled to the BBC in 1957.
I do think that probably the first manifestation of the power of broadcasting was in the United States of America. A delightful man whom I knew very well called Conrad of the Westinghouse Company of Pittsburgh, PA. And he just had one of the wireless transmitters and he had a microphone. And it occurred to him that on a Saturday night he might give the boys a treat. And he put on a few gramophone records and so on.
I shine, I cry, oh no, it's just a bit of heaven when my baby smiles at me.
And everybody, the amateurs, listened. And they enjoyed the little sounds that coming out. Because, you know, if you got a wireless set as an amateur which had never done more than go pa 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 pa, and then suddenly you heard a voice or even music, I mean, it was fascinating. And the date? Well, 1920.
Frank Conrad's little sounds in his so-called air concerts couldn't be heard in Europe, but he was one of the first people to use the term broadcasting outside the original agricultural sense to scatter seeds. He wondered, could it be possible that radio could be used to communicate with more than one person? An audience? At the same time, the Netherlands and Canada were starting stations too, but when it came to getting attention, it was a prima donna opera singer who would give her name to a pudding of poached peaches and a performance in Essex that would really capture the public's imagination. Media historian Professor Jean Seaton in 2012 in Archive on 4, Tuning In.
Dame Nellie Melba was the diva of her age. She was known everywhere. She was Australian. She was hugely regarded. The Daily Mail thinks that this new broadcasting lark might be something it can make a fuss about. So it gets Dame Nellie Melba in 1920 to trundle out to Chelmsford and sing. So it's one of those great events in which broadcasting, rather like perhaps the televising of the Queen's coronation, is suddenly becomes, we'd say these days, it goes viral. It becomes an event.
She was heard by people as far as 1,500 miles away, across Europe and as far as Iran and Canada. By the end of 1923, the British Broadcasting Company was a year old and able to relay broadcasts from that first commercial station, KDKA, in America, using shortwave. Peter Eckersley, so impressed with sounds that weren't just pa-pa-pa-pa-pa, was now the first chief engineer of what would become the British Broadcasting Corporation. Another radio pioneer, Harry P. Davis, the founder of KDKA, later wrote...
Here occurred an epoch in human history, for man had truly conquered space. A human voice was heard simultaneously in North America and Europe, a greeting to millions of people spanning nature's barriers, with no connecting media except the invisible and the unknown. Probably in all the years of history, no greater feat of science had been recorded.
This epoch has fascinated many, and one enthusiast has dedicated himself to making sure it's not forgotten.
My name's Thomas Witherspoon, and I created this website called the Shortwave Radio Audio Archive. I love archiving things, and I hate to think that sounds are lost over time. In the earliest days of home recording equipment, people started recording what they would hear on the air. So cassette tapes and reel-to-reel tapes and all these other things. And so I decided to kind of take it upon myself just to create this archive.
So what is the invisible feat of science those early pioneers talked about that happens when we hear sounds from a distant country?
Shortwave radio operates in the high frequency or HF band between about 3 and 30 megahertz. Shortwave uses skywave propagation. What happens is when the signal leaves a broadcaster's tower, the signal goes up into the ionosphere and it bounces off of it.
That's the section of the atmosphere which starts at about 53 miles up, above where the Earth's weather happens and above the ozone layer.
The ionosphere, which is this charged layer of the Earth's atmosphere, acts as a mirror that reflects the signal back down. And the really fascinating thing about it is, based on the frequency, the time of day, and using the science that we know as sky wave propagation, broadcasters can figure out what frequency to use, at what time of day, and where to target using the types of antennas that they have a certain region of the globe. So, for example, here in the States, we could target, say, Western Europe. And the footprint of that broadcast would be vast, much, much bigger than, say, an FM footprint, and possibly much more than a medium wave or AM footprint as well. And it doesn't stop there, though. Sometimes it skips and goes back up to the ionosphere and bounces back down. So maybe a program that was targeted for, say, Western Europe could also be heard in Asia.
With our first broadcast in English of the day, we wish you good reception conditions.
We have these signals that are invisible. We can't see them, of course, and our ears can't hear them, but they're bouncing all over the Earth all the time because the ionosphere, when it's charged, sort of contains them on our globe.
Can you describe the first time you heard shortwave?
I remember my dad had in our living room a 1936 RCA console radio that belonged to my grandfather. And my dad, every Sunday morning, would turn it on, and it was tuned to WWV Fort Collins, Colorado, which is a national institute. It's an NIST time station. And all it does is it broadcasts the time from an atomic clock. And one of the really fascinating aspects of radio is that it travels at the speed of light. So it is extremely accurate when you're listening to the atomic clock.
At the tone, 20 hours, 48 minutes, Coordinated Universal Time.
It's about the most accurate thing that you can listen to over the air. And my dad would set his watch to that station. Eventually, I got brave enough as a little kid to say, can I tune around and see what else I can hear on here? And I would tune, and I would hear things like Deutsche Welle.
This is Radio Deutsche Welle, the voice of Germany and Cologne.
Radio France International.
Don't forget to join us again tomorrow on Radio France International for Paris.
And Radio Moscow. And a whole bunch of other Cold War era stations and broadcasters from across the world. And then when I believe I was about 8 years old, a family member actually gave me a shortwave radio that belonged to their son. And it was a Zenith transoceanic transistor solid state radio. It was really beautiful. And I set it up in my bedroom and I could tune in the world with that. And I kept a logbook and had a map where I would put pins in of the stations that I heard across the globe. I loved Radio Netherlands.
From wherever you might be, you're tuned to Radio Nederland, the Dutch world.
They were the real innovators of the day. And they really did have a lot of shows that were sticky. People loved listening to them, like the Happy Station Show.
This is the Happy Station Show, your Sunday family show of Miles Across the Mile. Today, we have a visitor who, first of all, is going to treat us to a little song.
I also like listening to Radio Havana, Cuba, because I really love the music that was on it.
We'll hear more from Thomas and his amazing archive later, but first let's go back to December 1932 and the start of the BBC's Empire Service, as it was then called, a vital early moment for soft power through broadcasting. The new shortwave radio technology is allowing signals to be broadcast over vast distances, bouncing through the ionosphere, and a few days later, King George V uses it to deliver a Christmas message.
Through one of the marvels of modern science, I am enabled this Christmas day to speak to all my people throughout the empire.
In the Netherlands, companies with commercial interests in the Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia, had also formed a colonial broadcasting organisation.
Hello, dames en heren. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is station PHI of Philips Broadcasting Holland India.
It was another 6 years before the BBC began broadcasting in languages other than English. It launched an Arabic service in January 1938, quickly followed by Spanish and Portuguese for Latin America. But it was the crisis of September that year when British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain met with Adolf Hitler as the continent approached the brink of war, which saw the start of the first European language services. They were now a necessity, as Leonard Mile, broadcaster and BBC manager, recalled in 1985 for the corporation's oral history collection.
BBC broadcasting in German began very suddenly at the time of Munich. It looked as though we were going to war. There were people evacuating children from London, digging trenches, issuing gas masks, and the Prime Minister decided that he'd better broadcast to the British people to tell them why this was all happening. And the cabinet decided that the broadcast should also be translated into German and fed to Germany. And instructions were given to this effect, which only reached the BBC a matter of hours before Chamberlain started to broadcast. They grabbed people to translate it and announce it and started broadcasting in German that night. And it went on from there onwards in French, German and Italian.
For the same oral history collection, in 1989, Alan Bullock, who joined the European service in 1940, described how it was vital to counter German propaganda.
There must at some stage have been a decision that what we were going to do is to broadcast news, that this was the philosophy of the European service, and there's a very practical reason for that. Many people who were listening to us were doing so a great danger to themselves, and we had the competitive urge because we had a very powerful German service, the Goebbels propaganda outfit, which during a period when we were inevitably going to be having retreats and defeats and so on, they would be announcing these. If we were to establish our credibility at the very beginning, we had to show we weren't afraid to announce this and to explain it and so on.
Not only was Goebbels' Nazi news outfit announcing British retreats and defeats, but he was using a cast of people who sounded at least as if they should have been allies. Among them would be the American former Broadway showgirl with her blonde pin curls, Mildred Gillers, known as Axis Sally, speaking here in 1943.
This is Berlin calling, and I'd just like to say, girls, that when Berlin calls, it pays to listen.
The American-born Irish-raised William Joyce, known as Lord Haw-Haw, would become the best-known English-speaking voice of Nazi radio.
Germany calling, Germany calling, Germany calling.
Even by this time, England does not seem to have realised that her usual sanctimonious methods no longer fit in with the times in which we live.
The United States joined the war in 1941, and with that, they joined the Battle of the Airwaves. The Romanian-born John Houseman, best known as the actor and producer who worked with the Hollywood star Orson Welles, was interviewed by James Day in 1974 and talked about his time as director of Voice of America, or VOA as it came to be known.
About five, six, seven of us really created the Voice of America. There were no broadcasts of the Voice of America at all when we got there. And within about 7 months, there were about 800 a day.
In a special 40th anniversary radio programme in 1982, John Houseman and William Harlan Hale, who was the first voice on Voice of America, recalled the start. The recording is held at the US National Archives and was found with the help of historian Neil Levon.
I worked around the clock, for I had much to learn. I spent hours each day listening to the British and enemy broadcasts. We needed to create shows that would sound straightforward, truthful and clear, bearing in mind that many of our audience might be listening at the risk of their lives.
By a strange irony, it so happened that before the first broadcast, I had an invitation to go to a dinner and a ballet, and I was dressed accordingly for the occasion. I remember in the very first words that I used in the first broadcast that went out from this country, in the German language, I said, "Hier sprechen Stimmen
aus Amerika." Aus Amerika im Krieg. Unsere Stimmen kommen zu
In other words, voices from America. It was only a few months later that we finally were given the official title, The Voice of America.
The show was considered a success. The State Department was silent, but the White House monitored it and congratulated us. So did the British by transatlantic phone. Later, their underground monitoring stations in neutral and enemy territories reported that the Nazis had done their heaviest jamming of the war to prevent this first voice of America from being heard.
Jamming, intentionally disrupting radio communication, would prove the worth of what was being transmitted, but it was letters from listeners in occupied countries that solidified the success.
We were haunted during those first months of the war by the constant fear that the voice of America, no matter how carefully we prepared and transmitted it, would never be heard by those for whom it was intended. Finally, after many weeks, a letter arrived by a circuitous route from Cannes in France. You in America cannot imagine how even a few minutes of news from America, heard by a Frenchman, is spread around. An hour after it is heard, hundreds, thousands know the truth.
This is the voice of America. Ici New York.
With the war coming to its closing stages, on German radio, an inebriated-sounding Lord Horhor made his last broadcast as the Allies arrived in Berlin in 1945.
You have heard something about the Battle of Berlin. I would only say that the men who have died have given their lives to show that whatever else happens, Germany will live. Es lebe Deutschland. Heil Hitler. And farewell.
He would be tried for treason and hanged. In August 1945, the news came that the world had been waiting for. The Second World War had ended. This was repeated on a loop in English and Japanese by the Voice of America.
The White House has just announced that the Japanese government has accepted the peace proposal of the Allied governments. Stand by for further details.
日本の皆様, 発表を申し上げます。
80 years later at the White House, in March 2025, weeks after being returned to office on a promise to cut taxes, regulation and the size of government, Donald Trump issued an executive order to strip back the US Agency for Global Media. It oversees a number of news outlets, including Voice of America, Radio Free Asia, and Radio Free Europe. He accused it of left-wing bias, and more than 1,000 VOA employees were put on leave. The electric car billionaire Elon Musk, who was advising the president, wrote this on the social media platform X, voiced by a producer.
Yes, shut them down. One, Europe is free now, not counting stifling bureaucracy. Hello. Two, nobody listens to them anymore. Three, it's just radical left crazy people talking to themselves while torching $1 billion a year of US taxpayer money.
Like other big international media organisations that started on shortwave, such as the BBC, Deutsche Welle and France Media Monde, Voice of America, Radio Free Europe and Radio Free Asia have become much more, using other frequencies and also TV, websites, social media and partner stations to publish their content. In 2024, the US Agency for Global Media reported reaching an audience of more than 420 million people weekly in 64 languages. It requested $944 million from the US government to run it that year, pointing out that Russia and China were investing in media markets, including Indonesia, Pakistan, Africa, and Latin America. This was the sound as Voice of America went off the air in Africa a year later, recorded by a UK listener, Mark Hurst. Jamie Shea, formerly a NATO spokesperson, was among those critical of the decision.
I used the term soft power suicide. There was no overwhelming financial crisis in the US government that would have necessitated closing down these public broadcasting services. The second thing is that there was no alternative in terms of private sector media in the United States willing to pick up that mantle. Today, we are now in a much more competitive environment where China is learning soft power. Even Russia, despite its poor image, has a go at it with Sputnik, with RT China with CGTN, the Chinese Global Public Network. And these countries are putting large sums of money into this, as are Gulf states, as is Turkey with TRT International Broadcasting. So this is not the time for the United States to abandon the field to these state broadcasters.
Thomas Witherspoon, the shortwave enthusiast we heard from earlier, is certainly not abandoning the field. He's carefully collecting and cataloguing all the audio sent to him from radio's international past, because to him, the sounds he hears make him feel connected to the world in ways beyond the obvious. It goes much deeper than pushing narratives.
I enjoy so much about the medium that goes above and beyond just its ability to carry information. I love the sound of shortwave radio. I love the sonic texture of shortwave radio.
Coming to you from Seoul, the capital of the Republic of Korea. And now we begin our 30-minute transmission.
It is not perfect. It is not CD quality. You hear hiss, you hear background noise.
20 hours and 2 minutes GMT on the International Service of Radio LGS. Here is the news.
When you're tuned off of a station, you're hearing the remnants of our solar system and the Big Bang. For a long time, I just leave the radio on in the house, tuned to a station or waiting for a station to happen. Just let it play in the background and you just hear the static, HF static, when you're doing that. And I find it really soothing.
And you've researched the artists who've been influenced by shortwave as well, haven't you?
One who I really love is Joe Strummer with The Clash. He traveled around as a kid. I think his parents were diplomats, and he used to listen to the BBC World Service. You'll hear references to radio throughout, you know, a lot of his music. London calling through the faraway towns. Now war is declared, and battle come down. London calling. Also, Peter Gabriel. He's been noted as someone who's been influenced by shortwave radio and has brought a bit of that into his music. When the night shows, the signals grow on radios. I've always loved interval signals, which used to tell people, you know, hey, we're about to broadcast, you're on the right frequency for Radio Australia or whatever. It was just so fun to hear some of the different ditties that were played.
This is Radio Afghanistan calling Europe.
This is the voice of Turkey.
Sometimes it was like bird songs.
This is Radio RSA, the voice of South Africa from Johannesburg.
Jim, what sort of programs do you like on Radio RSA?
I like your native African music, and believe it or not, I like your very cheerful robin, which you use on your tuning signal. I think that's very wonderful.
Well, that's actually what is commonly known as a bok makiri.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes it was people playing drums. Some were, you know, really official and played like national anthems and things like that as well. But I love those interval signals.
And we close today's broadcast with a full news bulletin.
From the snippets Thomas Witherspoon has kept from the past to the debate about the Voice of America's future. In June 2025, Carrie Lake, the former TV anchor, appeared before Congress at the House Foreign Affairs Committee. She described being put in charge of the U.S. Agency for Global Media by President Trump.
Within days in my role as senior advisor, it became increasingly clear that reform was nearly impossible. The agency was incompetent and mismanaged and deeply corrupt, politically biased, and frankly, a serious threat to our national security.
She later said,
"This place is rotten. It's rotten to the core. President Trump has asked me to go in and help clean it up. And he's also issued an executive order to reduce this agency down to its mandate, to what is mandated, statutorily required. That's exactly what I'm doing. I don't care if they attack me. We're going to make it right for the American taxpayers."
Democrat Congressman Gregory Meeks set out his view.
What you're doing isn't efficiency. It's chaos.
The dysfunction lies in the administration's allergy to truth and democracy, the two pillars that USAGM aims to promote abroad. So I'm not surprised by the choice to gut USAGM, since the first Trump administration targeted the enterprise, violating laws and journalistic integrity to shape it into a state media like Russia's or North Korea's. Today, those regimes are actually cheering as we surrender another potent set of soft power tools and abandon the airwaves.
In Munich, a giant radio station, nearly three times as powerful as any in the United States, the 135,000-watt Radio Free Europe station was built with donations to the Crusade for Freedom by 16 million Americans.
That's a British Pathé report from 1951. In the decades after World War II, the Soviet Union and the United States were locked in a conflict of ideology. The Cold War was an era of paranoia, fear, and mutual suspicion, with a contest for supremacy spread across the globe. It was all about persuading other countries of your ideology, and radio was primed to be a soft power tool.
This radio station here doesn't beam its signal at the people of Western Germany, but at people living behind the Iron Curtain. It's just part of the Western armament engaged in the battle of the ether. In that Western armament, by far the biggest and most powerful weapon is called Radio Free Europe.
That was a BBC report from 1950. The station's former deputy director, Arch Puddington, explained more about the battle of the ether in 2025 in the BBC World Service's Witness History.
The communist strategy was to smother all independent voices. The press was completely censored. Anti-communist journalists were arrested or sent into exile. And there was one source of news, basically, and which was the communist government.
That was the Freedom Bell, to remind you that you are listening to Radio Free Europe.
While the US had Radio Free Europe, the Soviets had Radio Moscow.
I don't think there's a shortwave listener that I know of that hasn't heard Radio Moscow, if they're at least my age, which I'm in my 50s.
This is Radio Moscow, and here is the news. First, the headline. The Soviet Union and Austria have jointly called for the withdrawal of the Israeli forces from occupied Arab territories.
Radio Moscow had some wonderful programming that kind of gave you insight into what they wanted you to hear, what they wanted you to think and believe.
Hello, everybody. This is Moscow Mailbag coming round again. Today, your mailbag team is Doris Maxima, back from her holidays, and myself, Edward Dyatlov. Yes, Tom's gone on his holidays, and as I said, here's Doris back from hers, and looking very fit, I must say.
And I feel fit. The first thing I did on getting back was to fish out my umbrella. When I was on a Baltic cruise, it was sizzling hot, and everyone was saying, when's it going to rain? Well, here, when I got back, everyone was saying, rain, rain, go away, come back on another day. But more about my holiday next week, when I've had time to get dug in and have read some of your letters.
We can't wait for that. Doris Maxina, also known as Doris Hart, is an intriguing character. She's described in the book Kremlin Wives by Larissa Vasileva as a well-heeled English girl who had fallen in love with communism in the 1930s. She apparently met the chauffeur of the Soviet ambassador and moved to Russia with him. You heard her in 1976.
Often you could tell when maybe it was a genuine question and then maybe when it was a question that they just threw themselves a softball of something to pitch the party line and everything.
Well, who's our first letter from today, Edward?
An old friend of yours, Doris, Brian Hartley of Thornton-le-Field, asking what's being done to build up Anglo-Soviet relations.
A great deal's being done, Brian. Hello, Brian. It's nice to be talking to you again. You know, I think it would be no exaggeration to speak of a new stage in the development of Soviet-British relations. Very pleasant indeed. For one thing, it's been marked by a series of visits back and forth. It started after Harold Wilson's visit to Moscow in February of last year for talks with Leonid Brezhnev, the Soviet Communist Party's general secretary. And after that, there was a marked increase in business, in trade, and cultural contacts.
I think from a really young age, I learned the difference between subjective and objective by listening to such a wide variety of broadcasters. So I could, in my mind, know was, that sounds like propaganda to me. Our online media and social media, they put us in echo chambers and it divides us. And the algorithms are based on capturing our emotions with anger and fear and all those things. And they put us in these communities where we can just grow angrier, right? And we're not listening. We're not branching out and hearing what other voices say. I think that shortwave radio was like my introduction into critical thinking. Radio Toronto was one I listened to as well. It was another really kind of hardline station. Cold War stations that did propaganda, you know, they'd have people on there from the countries they were targeting. And so they sounded like the person next door in a lot of ways, but they were towing the party line of whatever country they were in.
In this Cold War period, Albania, under Enver Hoxha, virtually a hermit kingdom, broadcast in more than 20 languages on Radio Tirana. It reached Brazilian guerrillas, Maoist factions across Asia, Africa and Latin America, and many other listeners around the world, like Thomas Witherspoon, of course. You might wonder how English speakers from democratic countries ended up broadcasting communist propaganda, and that's where the New Zealander June Taylor can shed some light, as she was the person next door. She was the English-speaking voice of communist Albania. Oral historian John Escombe spoke to her in 2022. She said it was her adopted father, Ron, a dentist, who first felt the allure of communist ideology.
He was absolutely mind-blown with Albania and how it was building socialism. And I think probably that was why he took his whole family to Albania in 67, yeah.
June was 16. It was supposed to be a two-year stay, but it lasted more than 20. Ron was to work at Radio Tirana before translating Hodge's writing. Meanwhile, June was directed by the Central Committee to study French at the University of Tirana, and it was suggested she worked part-time at the radio station. Her reaction?
I can't do that work. And he said, yes, you can. Come on and have a try anyway. You had what they called the supervising editor who held the Albanian script of what you were reading and checked everything you said against the Albanian. So you couldn't say whatever it was you wanted to say yourself. The materials that were written by the actual journalists in Radio Tirana were all written on the basis of directives that were given by the Central Committee. I know that very little research was done. You just didn't do research, because if you did research, then, you know, another side of the story would come out and the truth would come out. And then where would you be?
Apart from the listeners' letters, did you have any sense of an audience?
I knew that people were listening, but I wasn't really sure that we had a very broad audience. I mean, I was told at one particular moment that a lot of the Marxist-Leninist movements throughout the world were regular listeners.
And it was to this audience that the teenager who'd been reluctant to audition 18 years before had the task of announcing the death of the dictator.
There was such an anxiety in that radio that day. I remember people were like, there was such a hush all over the place. I mean, I remember going into the studio that day, they must have changed that text like a million times. And you know, take this bit out, and then somebody would come in from the directory and say, no, hang on a minute, let me hear this. So finally they came back with this, I think it was about one page. And I remember my editor looking at me and saying, you have to do it slowly, for God's sake. Slowly. Yes, I said, I'm going to do it slowly. You have to do it with this voice. And then he said, like your father died. I said, right. So, yeah.
With the deepest grief, we inform you that today, the 11th of April 1985, at 2 hours 15, the heart of the beloved and glorious leader of the party and our people, Comrade Enver Hoxha, First Secretary of the Central Committee of the Party of Labour of Albania, Chairman of the General Council of the Democratic Front of Albania, Commander-in-Chief of our armed forces, ceased to beat. He who created the Democratic Front and laid the foundations of the people's power closed his eyes forever.
So I read it. I do remember everybody sitting on the other side of the recording studio, on the other side of the window there. What did she say? What did she say? And it was, the translator was, would you just leave me alone? I'm trying to follow what she's saying. And everyone was going, what is she saying? What is she saying?
As communist regimes collapsed across Europe, Albania's government clung to power.
The Central Committee was in a real turmoil, and the Central Committee was not sending down directives anymore. Subsequently, so was the radio in a mess. And so slowly things started to change within the radio, and all of a sudden we were broadcasting Western music, you know, Western songs. I remember the internal radio did a thing on Tom Jones because he was a miner's son. But he got this whole thing in his songs and all of that. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. So, yeah, things started to change. Pussycat, I've got flowers and lots of hours to spend with you. And when it came down to political decisions and on what we should be transmitting, it was a real mess.
The people of this country, isolated for so long, became stirred by the crumbling of communism, which began with the fall of the Berlin Wall. The government even legalised opposition parties.
We started broadcasting articles that we'd never dream of broadcasting. I remember announcing stuff about interviews that had been done with the different political leaders now and different opinions on things. And, yeah, pluralism.
After the collapse of the regime in Albania in the early 90s, June went back to New Zealand. Other stations were also affected by the demise of communism. The medium of shortwave survived, but what was being broadcast on it was changing.
I have in the archive one of the very last recordings of Radio Berlin International after integration between East and West. And they started off with a song by the heavy metal band Europe, called The Final Countdown, because it was the final countdown to the end, really, of Radio Berlin International.
That broadcast came to you from Radio Berlin International, the voice of the disappearing German Democratic Republic.
Their whole career, these people have been talking about the horrible things about the West, right, and how good it was over on the East side. So all of a sudden, they're being integrated.
My things and leave now, but not without saying thank you to all of your listeners of RBI who have kept faith with us for so long. And it's bye-bye from your program host, Kitty Sievert.
While some stations packed their bags, the BBC World Service continued.
I'm John Tusa. I was managing director of the BBC World Service from 1986 to 1992. And that is the time when the Cold War ended, 89-90. It was a time when communism and the struggle between Marxism-Leninism and free market economics was still at a very, very intense period. And what I think the World Service did, it wasn't so much engaged in that argument, but we always said that what we did was to present as many of the facts as people needed about their life as accurately, as completely as possible. And we knew that, say, in closed societies, particularly like the Soviet Union, people knew that they were getting information which they could not get from their own domestic sources. And that was something that was extremely important.
Sir John Tusa was part of an unimaginable period now, when a special broadcasting agreement was reached between the BBC and Radio Moscow. With the fall of the Iron Curtain, there was a desire to share British know-how on a wide range of educational, commercial, legal and political matters, with states transitioning away from communist one-party rule. And one of the ways the BBC achieved this was to share The Archers. Квартира Антиловых. Domsiem Putyes Chatira, or Domsiem as it was known, translates as House 7, Entrance 4. It was a daily radio soap opera set in a contemporary Moscow apartment block, and storylines included people setting up their own small businesses.
Алло, я слушаю.
Да, Дим, скажите, замри.
It was produced in Moscow by a team of Russian writers and actors. Members of the crew visited the set of The British Archers in 1994, as reported on BBC Midlands Today.
The Archers is a veteran of 43 years. Dom Siem's a mere 2 years old. Set in an apartment block, it's a violent, tough portrayal of everyday life in the Russian capital.
It's about real life, about people in Moscow, in a house with a Dom Siem. It's a house, block number 7. It's everyday problems and everyday dramatic stories.
4 of the Russians joined the Archers cast to improve their skills. They'd been taught from scratch in Moscow by a former Archers editor. They were able to watch the finer points of production techniques and pick up valuable hints for their own programme. In Moscow, Dom Siem is already developing an appreciative audience, for so many years accustomed only to propaganda on the radio.
Step by step, we become free.
While accurate listening figures aren't available, the Independent newspaper reported in 1997 that the UK government estimated 3 million people were tuning in every day for that particular example of the subtle attraction of soft power. As well as adapting to the shifting needs of world audiences, Sir John Tusser oversaw the introduction of new technology, satellite television, because soft power through broadcasting wasn't just about radio anymore.
You should keep trust with the listening audience by broadcasting to them on a constant basis, not saying, oh, I'm terribly sorry, you no longer matter very much, there isn't a crisis here, there isn't a British foreign policy interest here, so we can now take you for granted, so we'll stop broadcasting to you. And then suddenly we say, oh, whoops, there's a crisis. Now we think we'd better start telling you what's going on because the Foreign Office wants to start telling you what is going on. That is a much weaker position than the one which says, we're talking to you the whole time because we believe in the flow of free information. And, you know, I'm not aware that the flow of free information stops being important at any particular time. If you believe in it, you should do it. And the sums of money involved are pathetic. When people say, oh, there's not enough money, what absolute and utter rubbish. And when people say, oh, we can't put in another 200 million, when you look at the cost of defence, and I'm not against that by the by, but when you look at how much has to be spent on defence, and you look at how much broadcasting you can get for fractions of that broadcasting, and broadcasting constantly, that is incredible value for money. To lose Voice of America, RFE, was a major, major blow. I can't begin to think why the United States authorities did it. I suppose they regarded them somehow as being maybe too left-wing, too liberal, too independent or something, but it was a great, great loss to the American presence. And after all, you're filling airwaves. There's a space. There's a listening space. And if you're not broadcasting into it, somebody else will be, and you know who it is. It's Radio Moscow. It's Radio Beijing. You need to fill the space.
Today, the World Service has a weekly audience reach of 312.8 million, including English and 42 other languages. But in March, a report from the Public Accounts Committee, which examines the value for money of government spending, warned the World Service was in danger of losing ground to its rivals, driven in part by increased international media spending of state actors such as Russia and China. Since 2014, the service has been funded by a combination of the licence fee and a grant from the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. The same report said the total budget had fallen 21% in real terms in the last 5 years, mainly because of reductions in contributions from the licence fee. In the same month, the government announced it would increase funding over the next 3 years by £11 million each year. Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper said, "This further increase in support ensures that independent, impartial reporting continues to reach audiences who depend on it." Also in March, a year after President Trump's order to cut the funding of USAGM, a federal judge ruled that Carrie Lake had not had the authority to close the Voice of America and its sister stations. Patsy Widakuswara was White House bureau chief at VOA before the bulk of its funding was removed. She was also a lead plaintiff in a lawsuit against the government. She spoke to the World Service.
They dismantled everything in terms of our physical infrastructure. I don't even have my badges. They confiscated our equipment, our laptops and everything, shuttered satellite studios and so on. So the judge has accepted a staggered plan to bring us back to work. Getting our physical infrastructure back will take time and a lot of taxpayers' money, but that's not our hardest work. I think the hardest part of all is to regain the trust of the weekly global audience that relied on VOA that we have ignored for the past year.
For some, a return to what it was doing isn't what's needed. Significant change is. Ivana Stradner was born in Serbia and is a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in the United States.
I do believe that the Voice of America should have been reformed a long time ago. The Voice of America and other similar media platforms are not perfect. We don't need to really shut them down. All we had to do is to reform them. Number one that I would do, I would definitely make the content more exciting for the young audience. I would make more podcasts. I would work more closely with social media influencers. Russia has been in this battlefield for a very long time. And of course, such social media tweets or posts on Instagram are not going to be visible, that you can see that it's coming from Russian intelligence. They have really, really adapted their influence operations. They have leveraged AI. I have to admit that I'm very, very concerned about the future of the information space unless we really wake up and put our adversaries on the defensive.
What is happening to soft power in that information space? A lot of the media organisations that started on shortwave 100 years ago still exist, but they have evolved. They can use medium wave, FM, digital platforms and partner stations to reach their radio audiences across borders. There's also satellite for radio and TV, the internet and social media. And while shortwave radio was still a major part of a broadcaster's toolkit in the 1990s, it arguably isn't today, except in some regions and in conflict zones where it can bypass government censorship.
It's true. It's a medium that's sunsetting for broadcasters, you know, and has been for a long time. And it just has to do with the audience not being there. So these are stations that are off the air. Swiss Radio International, The Voice of Greece, Radio Canada International, Radio Netherlands, Radio Norway.
From the very end of the very last broadcast of Radio Netherlands in English. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye!
So has soft power been adapted well enough as platforms and technology have evolved?
My name's Nick Newman. I'm a senior research associate at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism. And before that, I used to work at World Service many years ago and at the BBC News website, where I was the founding international news editor. I think the key way of delivering soft power in the future is going to be through multiple channels. We know that more attention, particularly for younger people, comes through accessing news through social media or through digital channels. And so you have to basically take your messages to where audiences are spending their time. I think the biggest change right now is not the end of soft power or of, you know, international broadcasters. It's more about the fragmentation of the information ecosystem, and it's really about how these things coexist. So global broadcasters like the BBC continue to be important for many audiences, highly trusted in many countries. You also have state broadcasters. But now, on top of that, we've got everything else through social media, and that includes activists, it includes influencers and creators. It also includes diaspora media that quite often is highly trusted by people inside the country. So the BBC and others are really competing for attention with many, many more sources of information. And that also creates confusion for audiences as well in terms of who to trust. We're certainly seeing significant change in the way in which state actors are trying to get their messages across. So not just through traditional state broadcasters, but increasingly through working with influencers or using sort of what's called network propaganda with creators, where individuals are often working together, often in a coordinated way to sort of flood the zone with messages and get round algorithms. So there's new forms of disinformation. One of the things that comes out of research again is that people really want trusted, impartial, accurate, and transparent news. Time and time again, we see people in information situations that are chaotic trying to access that kind of information.
Professor Joseph Nye, who coined the term soft power, said this in an interview just before he died last year. He was speaking on the Harvard Kennedy School's policy cast.
We've had presidents who were skilled at hard power, but they've usually had the sense to combine it with soft power. What I don't see in President Trump, particularly in the second vintage, is any sensitivity to that usefulness of combining soft and hard power. Another way of putting it is if you use a little honey, you can economize on carrots and sticks.
He talks about soft power having cycles.
I think we're in another downturn. I suspect that if we have this interview a year from now, we'd be saying this is a down cycle.
Does the archive teach us anything? Well, perhaps it's that broadcasters are always jostled by the whims and demands of political situations and the ideologies of the day. They change as the competing interests of the world shift, like the signals coming down from the ionosphere in strange, unpredictable places.
This is the Korean Central Broadcasting Station, Pyongyang.
The pioneers of international radio used the latest science and technology to test the possibilities of how humans could reach each other in the 1920s, and they'd surely want us to do the same in the 2020s. We can't know where that will take us. The soft power battle continues, and the result of that fight will affect us all. Radio, having firmly been a soft power weapon in its earliest days and through the Cold War, is changing. And while the ways that we hear the spoken voice and its subtle persuasion are altering, the archive reminds us that from Frank Conrad in his garage having a bit of fun on a Saturday playing records for the boys, to the Happy Station show with its smiles across the miles, there's someone else out there with us. It gives us collective experience. I hope you've enjoyed this one.
This transmission is now closing down. Please retune to our transmission in the 90-meter band.